God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. You have the ability to unmute and just give us your first name if you'd like. Anybody? First 30 days. All right. Do you guys know the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous is officially changed? Here's what it sounds like now. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to welcome Meg B. from Concord, California, I think is correct. And so after she tells her story, we'll take a break somewhere around the top of the hour. We'll call for announcements, Path to Seven Tradition Basket, et cetera. And then we'll reconvene and we're going to ask her questions. And the questions that we ask are the questions that you submit through the chat to the user questions. We don't have a list of questions in the can. So please, as questions occur to you, please chat them to the user questions. So been looking forward to this all day. Meg, thank you so much for coming to join us tonight. I give you Meg.
Hi, everybody. I'm Meg Baker. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me. Simple Actions Group. Way to start taking action. You already got your preamble updated. Good on you. We had a big old conversation about that at my home group. I'm the secretary, which my part of my, you know, realm of responsibility is the format. And I had asked the group months ago, did we want to do it? And we was talking about it. We had opinions. We had a majority. Then we had a minority opinion. Then we had a majority going the other way. It was like, whoa, the group conscience really, really, really was fiery over that one. Lo and behold, we decided to do it. And look, the fellowship as a whole decided to do it. I love change in AA. I'm terrified of it, but I think it's awesome. So that makes me excited to hear you do that tonight. Anyway, my sobriety date is February 29th, 2008. Right now I live in Martinez. I think when David asked me, I probably lived in Concord. I just bought a new house and moved. I live in the northern coast of California up in the Bay Area. So it's sunny and hot out here. and happy Memorial Day. Isn't this awesome? We get off tomorrow for the most part. And if you have to work tomorrow, maybe we just be grateful we have a job, because I know that wasn't always the case for me. I watched a movie. We had, I live with my husband, who I met in AA. We've both been sober. He's been sober way longer than me. And, you know, when you stay in AA for a little bit, most of your friends are in AA. And because we have this new house, we had what I would call elder statesmen in our community, a married couple, come by and have dinner with us. And we love movies. We love movies. We have an Oscar party. My husband and I got engaged at this other couple's house because they love movies at their Oscar party. And our house has a cool, this how spoiled I am. We have a movie theater room, you guys. It's like a screen that comes out. And this couple came over and we had dinner and we thought, let's watch a war movie for Memorial Day. And we watched Saving Private Ryan. Oh my God, you guys, that, I mean, just if you love movies, that is intense, but what an accurate depiction of the hells of war and these lives and these young men and these children out on this battlefield and like the human instinct and the battle of like how to just be present over this human instinct. And it made me think of our Grapevine magazine. I don't know if you guys got a chance to go to the international convention that happens every 5 years. Did not happen. Thank you, COVID. Cleared off the calendar for that. But they did an online thing. And the Grapevine did like a little video, and it was so cool. I watched it, and in there, I didn't know this, but if you know the Grapevine magazine, it's called The Meeting in Print. And that's because World War I soldiers were using the Grapevine to participate in AA. And I just, look how I did that. I tied in Memorial Day to AA. See how I did that? And I just thought, man, that's so cool. Because look, I got my Grapevine in the mail today. And I thought, wow, you know, how lucky are we that this is a little foo-foo extra thing that we don't even really think we need. And back then, this was the way people got AA, and where we've come and where we are in AA and how freaking cool this time is. Like, we have the opportunity to go places we've never been in our sobriety. But that's neither here nor there. You guys asked me to come you and talk to you about how I got to where I am in my sobriety. And I have an hour. I have a friend who every time he hears somebody at charity meeting, he goes, thanks, love you, love your show. So it's kind of funny that he's not here tonight because it's an hour show tonight. So settle in. I'll tell you about, I always think it's so crazy. I think about the first meetings I went to and the speakers that I heard talk and my impression of what was going on in AA. I was showing up to churches, a lot of churches, and seeing very clean cut people, a lot of older gentlemen in suits looked really well put together. And I just felt like, what is going on here? I am like a low bottom hood rat. Is this the place for me? And I would hear these people, I mean, they get into it and they start telling their stories. I'll never forget one guy was talking about how he hit bottom in Haight-Ashbury in the 60s and like was doing lines of coke off naked women. And I got so excited. I was like, yay, thank God, you are my people. See through the suit. So I love the way AA works, where I got to tell you where I came from. Or you don't care about where I am today. It doesn't mean anything if you can't see the miracle in my life. So that being said, I have to start telling you my deepest, darkest secrets with humility and honesty. And guess what? I'm cool with that. I'm so cool with that. When I showed up to AA, it was 2008. I was 34 years old. I was a daily drinker, which means that as soon as I got out of bed, I drank. I had all the earmarks of an alcoholic. I couldn't hold a job. I was getting arrested. I couldn't maintain relationships. I frequently had black eyes. I tried to give black eyes, but I'm a weakling, not very strong. So I got them more than I gave them. You know, in debt, can't support myself. And my drinking was just front and center, large and in charge. And that was as good as my life had been in years. Alcoholism is so, so tricky. It's really cunning, baffling, and powerful, as they say. But I mean, there's some words to relay a very, very, very big thing. I grew up in Philadelphia. I'm an East Coast hood rat. And I grew up in a large Irish Catholic family. Stereotypes exist in every culture. They're usually true. I will say they were true for me. What that meant for me was I was around a lot of alcoholic behavior, a lot of alcoholic drinking. It was always present, and I had a lot of weird ideas about alcohol that I had learned from watching this behavior in my family. For instance, you know, my mom's mom died at 57 on the couch of alcoholism. She was an abusive parent. My mom had 13 children. The dad left, and they were just in utter poverty, like WT white trash, utter poverty in Northeast Philadelphia. She was the crazy lady on the block. The house had broken windows and no electricity. And that was because of alcoholism. And, you know, that was an extreme case. And you can imagine the trauma that goes on for 13 children to grow up in a home like that. And on the other side, my dad grew up in a family of seven. His mom became a widow when he was 11 years old. He's the oldest. And, you know, she was an alcoholic. She was able to keep it together a little bit. She was more of a functioning alcoholic, but still alcoholic home. And so I'm raised by two parents who were raised by alcoholics. And they would always tell me, you cannot drink. We have alcoholism in our family. Please, you cannot drink. But what I would see is every family event, whether it be a celebration or a sadness, was fueled by alcohol, blackberry brandy in your jean jacket on the steps, keg parties at first birthday parties, and Irish wakes and Irish whiskey, and just everything had alcohol present. And it was very confusing, because what I also saw was a lot of love and a lot of family ties and bonds being made over alcohol and late night singing parties. I was raised by teenage hippies. I mean, I knew every Crosby, Stills, and Nash song by the time, I was in second grade. Joni Mitchell is like an aunt to me. A lot of love was exhibited to me, and I associated it with alcohol. So it was very attractive to me. And what happened was, not weird for AA, weird for the world, at about 11, I started to experiment with alcohol. You know what? I want to tell you one story first, because the longer I stay sober, the more I can see alcoholism be present in my life before I drank. And that is one thing that I did not know about alcoholism till I needed to get sober, was that it's a spiritual malady. Are you kidding me? Like, is this the worst disease in the world, to have a physical allergy to alcohol and a spiritual malady? Like, come on. But I didn't know that spiritual malady piece. And when I look back at my life, I could see how alcoholism showed up just in time to save my ass, because I didn't know how to deal with the spiritual malady, no tools. But what happened for me was, loving environment. My parents were teenage hippies. They sold weed to pay for the mortgage. My mom worked in a gas station when I was a baby, and like, I was just being carted around, these two kids were trying to make it work. They got married very young, and I was often babysat by uncles, aunts, grandparents, went to work at the gas station with my mom, and they always sold weed. And I remember in fourth grade, Ronald Reagan was president, and Nancy Reagan was doing her Just Say No pitch, and it sounded great. And we had the DARE people come to school and teach us about drugs, no, no bad. And I'm thinking, shoot, I know what my parents do. I got to do something about that. Very like young, idealistic sense of righteousness and justice, and like feeling very empowered by this information, by the community, peers, and my teachers. I was in choir. I sang at mass every Sunday and was like a straight A student. And I was also a latchkey kid, because those parents had to work their asses off to make ends meet on top of selling weed to pay the mortgage. And I got home from school and I took the pound of weed out of the secret spot and flushed it all down the toilet. You guys, I don't know. I mean, weed is legal now, so I don't know the last time anyone had to flush that much weed down the toilet. It takes forever. It took like hours. And by the time my parents got home, I had successfully gotten it all down the drain. They found out, and man, was I in trouble. I was in trouble. I mean, that was a mortgage payment. And I couldn't reconcile that, why I was getting in trouble for something that I thought was right. And not only that, but, I had to tell my friends I couldn't come out and play because I was grounded for like 3 months, by the way, and make up a lie about it. And I think somewhere the switch flipped, like the truth is bull, you got to make your own destiny in the world, and you don't need to be honest. It was, off the table at that point. And guess what? That summer I started drinking. I started stealing little Rolling Rock ponies from the refrigerator and experimenting. I started smoking weed, and I found something that I loved. I felt grown up. I felt purpose. I felt powerful. And I just kept doing it. And I would find people that would want to do that with me, people as in other kids, and we would sneak out to the tracks and, steal from babysitters. We're children, how much drinking can you really do? And I'd get in trouble all the time. And this is where I started to hear from my parents, like, you can't drink. Alcoholism is in our family. It's going to be a problem. And I just knew, like, no way, man, I'm not giving this up. This is so fun. And I made a little kind of secret deal with myself, like, just say yes. Yes, I understand. Talk the game. And in the back, if it gets to be a problem, I'll just stop. And this is where I think, dang, that's so interesting that my family has all this alcoholism and nobody really knows what it is, because nobody gave me the information that alcoholism means that when it is a problem and when you want to stop, you don't have the power to do it, that it gets bigger and stronger than you if you're not careful. And I don't know that that would have done anything for me, because I mean, it was awesome. I loved it. And the other thing that started to happen was it was solving problems. You know, I went from 11 to 12 to 13, and I got out of grade school and had to go to high school. And my parents, we lived in the ghetto in Philly, and I was the only white kid in my neighborhood. And my parents always focused on education. And, you know, none of that matters. It just means that I always had proof why I was different than everybody. And we were like the brokest kids in the neighborhood. And I would get made fun of for wearing bell bottoms in the 80s, 70s, polyester bell bottoms, hand-me-downs. I'm really dating myself. Just go with it. And they paid for me to go to this private Catholic school in the suburbs. And when I got out there, all these private Catholic suburb kids had gone to grade school together and everybody knew each other. And here's me. So you know I drank out there. And I quickly found the kids that drank. And alcohol did what it does. It changed the way I feel. It gave me a pass on having to feel uncomfortable. It gave me a pass on having to figure out how to get through hard things in life. It did it for me. And I didn't know I was doing that. I really didn't know. I thought I was just showing up for the party and like finding like an awesome way to get through stuff. I had all of my firsts under the influence of alcohol. My first kiss was on train tracks in the middle of a snow holiday with a stolen bottle of church wine. My first school dance, alcohol, all of it, you know. And the one thing that always kept me going kind of under the radar was I did good in school. I just could do it. It wasn't that much work. And, you know, we'd get in trouble and my friend's parents would be like, oh, Megan's not bad because we saw her name in the paper. She made Dean's List or she's on the honor roll. Like she can't be a bad influence. And little did they know that I'm this little baby alcoholic constantly like, let's go more and more and more. Don't, you're a weakling. Why are you throwing up in the bathroom? Let's go, you know. and before, you know, other stuff comes along with that. I was a huge kleptomaniac and also a pathological liar, all of that stuff, you know, just more ways I found to like get a little power in the game, control the outcome and not learn how to live life on life's terms at all. What happened was I got a scholarship to college. Yeah, that's good for a little broke girl because your parents aren't paying for it. And I went to Millersville University, which is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, home of the Amish. Don't worry, there was drinking to be found and I found it. And it was not very long before I could not go to class. I was, you know, always missing class and always looking for the party. And I started to get in trouble around it up there. I started to get consequences. I got on a disciplinary probation for having beer in my dorm room and I could not do school. It was not easy anymore. It required a little more effort than I had to give and I failed. And they took my scholarship away and I had to move home with the tail between my leg. And that was really the first time that I was like, maybe drinking got in the way of that. So, you know, we don't ever think, well, stop drinking. We're so smart. We have so many good ideas. My idea was I'll move home and go to community college for nursing and shift into, you know, less drinking. So what that meant was I moved home, went to nursing school in the neighborhood, and I cut back the drinking to between Thursday and Sunday. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday was my new drinking schedule. Which is kind of funny because there's only 7 days in the week. So I thought I was doing good that I was only drinking four of them. And I supplemented the remaining three because sober is unheard of with smoking weed. Grades come back up, heats off, back on course, nothing to see here. Aversion. We averted the problem. And then what happened was I turned 21, which is a magical number for a young alcoholic, because what that means is I'm no longer standing in the parking lot asking strangers to go buy me liquor. And you guys, I am, you can't tell, but I'm 5 feet tall and I have a freckle face. So, you know, it was always hard to get alcohol. People think I'm a little baby still. Now I like it. Before it was a problem. Now I'm happy for it. And I had this magical, powerful ID that would get me into bars and nightclubs and liquor stores. You know, in Pennsylvania, we have blue laws. So like you have to buy your liquor at a liquor store and go to special places on Sundays. And I had the power. I had access. I could go do it. And I graduated nursing school and I had the money and it all lined up and it was good. Life was good. And scary things started happening. Now that I have unlimited access to alcohol, my drinking, I imagine that my alcoholism is on a radio dial. Every now and then it just goes, bloop, let's switch to the next channel where things get a little more intense. And I started to black out frequently. And, you know, I had the ability to buy cars, I was totaling cars, just finding myself in a lot of terrifying circumstances. I was getting arrested in bars and nightclubs for being a fiery little asshole. There were times where I got arrested while getting arrested. Let me unpack that for you. Like I got picked up for drunk and disorderly conduct. And then in the police station, would find that I was being disrespected by a cop. So I would start a fight with a cop and now like more charges are layered on. This was normal for me. And you could not tell me that it was because of me and my behavior and my drinking. It was always, well, of course I got the one asshole cop in Philly, or of course, you know, like it was a full moon, or, you know, just really weird. Oh, I can't go back to that bar. I have never drank in that neighborhood and I never will again, you know, or this one was a good one. I was doing the Atkins diet. So I really like my food was off, you know, like when you're on Atkins, you can only drink alcohol. You can't put mixers in it because then you blow the Atkins. So it was like stuff like that. And it just took me to some scary places. And then what I know now, I did not know then, but what happens, and I'm not saying this is unique to young women who black out, who are blackout drinkers in their early 20s, but when you are a young woman in your early 20s and you wake up in strange places with strange people, can't remember large chunks of time, have identified bruises on you, like you start to become terrified when you're sober. And after the terrified comes shame and guilt. And that is not cool, not tolerable. I told you I've been drinking since I'm 11. I learned I don't have to feel uncomfortable. Alcohol changes the way I feel. And that terror, shame, and guilt of those kind of morning afters, it's given me chills just thinking about it. So you know what I do? I drink about it. I get relief. I go out, I'm an alcoholic. I have no control over the amount I take. I have no control what happens to me when I drink. Guess what happens? Black out, wake up in weird places, get arrested, total cars, wake up with black eyes, wake up with, you know, no money and no clothes, or wake up totally dressed head to toe in your jacket and your shoes in your car, wake up and pieces of your car are missing, like that kind of stuff. And then guess what we do? Terror, shame, and guilt, drink, black out, consequences. Can't deal with the consequences. And this crazy, crazy cyclone starts whirling in my life. And I don't see a way out. And I can't connect the dots that it's because of my drinking and my drinking is a problem. I don't get that. And I don't get why I drink because of a spiritual malady, because I'm ill-equipped for life. And it starts giving me those alcoholic signs and symptoms, you know, or I am in denial about it. And I have self-pity and my emotions become so heavy. They feel like wearing wet clothes covered in sand all the time. I'm just overwhelmed by my emotions out of proportion. I know today that's called lack of humility, like not being right-sized or living in the truth. I didn't know that then. I just knew that I knew how to change that stuff and it required more and more alcohol. What happened? I mean, this is like the beginning of my alcoholism, you guys. I got a job. I graduated nursing school. Dean's this. Woo-woo. All right. And I got a job. There's always a nursing shortage. Always a nursing shortage. So my nursing school were happy to give me a job. And then it was the early 90s and healthcare has been a shit show forever. It was no different back then. The hospital could not survive and had to like make cuts and everybody had to reapply for their job. So I'm like 6 months new grad working on med surg floor, which is just regular hospital floor. And I was getting laid off and had to reapply for other positions. And I just thought, what the heck, let me apply to be an ER nurse. How freaking cool would that be? And I got the job. and I'm 25 and I got this badass emergency room job. It's night shift. I'm working in the ghetto neighborhood I grew up in, which guess what that means? I mean, it's not fun to live there, but what it means as a nurse is lots of trauma experience. I mean, it was like Cops, the episode of Cops every night, people just rolling up, shot, bubble jackets, down feathers flowing everywhere, and like crack epidemic is in full swing. And like, it was so exciting and also terrifying. And for someone who has no idea how to feel emotions, like I was completely numbed out to the stress of what was going on for me. All these good things happening to me. I met a guy, we've been together for a while. I was pregnant. We were going to have a baby. I mean, if I put life goals on paper, check, check, and check. I got a man, I'm having a baby, I got this badass career, I'm paying my bills. I'm 25. You know, like if you could relate to Bill Wilson in his story where he's, you know, a successful stockbroker and he has his I had arrived moment. That was me, children, let me tell you. But if you're an alcoholic, like I'd be an alcoholic, if life shows up, whether it be good or bad, you're screwed, you know, if you don't have a solution, which I had not one. And what happened for me is my alcoholism, here goes the radio doll, whoo, we changed to another way it looked like. And I started, are you ready for this? This is my best solution. I'm asked to be sober. I want to be a good mom because I'm pregnant. I want to be a good mom. I want to do this. I want to love this baby. I'm here for it. I've never been sober since I started drinking at age 11. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to feel emotions. I don't know how to manage stress. I don't even know how to identify emotions, much less figure out how to handle it. So the best thing I could come up with was I started drinking probably like 3 months into my pregnancy, slowly followed by weed. That's harmless. I mean, there's a whole religion called Rastafari where pregnant women smoke pot all the time. I mean, they're not getting arrested, so that's cool. I kind of hid the drinking. I only did it on the weekends, control as best I could. But what I did in secret was I started to divert and steal Demerol, Dilaudid, morphine, and inject it while at work. I became an IV drug abuser while 5 months pregnant. That's my best ability to be sober. That's all I got, you guys. I don't know how to do anything different. Guess what comes back? Terror, shame, guilt, unbearable, unbearable. I mean, I want to tell you the darkness of that way of living, it gives me chills. Look, I just want to show you though over here. See that? That's my kid. He's cool. He's all right. He made it. I like to just let you know that. But it was dark. I would go into the work. I would immediately steal drugs. I would, you know, pick and choose, cherry pick my patients. I love sickle cell patients. I love cancer patients. Anybody who's got heavy narcotics associated with their treatment that I know I can get right away, go in the bathroom, shoot up, go immediately into an empty room and get a little Doppler and listen for a heartbeat. Because I know what I'm doing is like a monster. I know I'm being a monster. And if I hear a heartbeat, I keep doing what I'm doing. I heard a heartbeat every time. I kept doing what I was doing. My son was born addicted to drugs. No one knew what was going on because on the outside I have freckles and red hair and I'm 5 feet tall and I look like this cute little together lady. And he had to spend the first night of his life in the neonatal intensive care unit going through respiratory withdrawal from narcotics. I didn't tell a soul. I didn't have it. I didn't have the strength. I could not put words to it. It was a dirty little secret that I just wanted to go away. Well, what's that got to do with AA? Let me tell you, because what happened next was I lost my nursing license. My son, you know, recovered and I drank. I thought, you know, with that going on, if alcohol is all I'm doing, then everyone's lucky. And that's minimal. I didn't recognize the power of alcohol. I didn't know. I mean, I don't know if you guys got this, but in the grapevine, there is alcohol at large and they do like scientific stuff. There's a doctor from Harvard and a doctor from Stanford who wrote a study. They like took analysis of studies on alcoholism. And it's in the back of our grapevine. Alcohol is the most lethal drug. 3.3 million people die from it a year. Most lethal drug. And to me, I think it's like kid stuff. You know, I didn't realize how powerful it was. And I certainly don't know about the spiritual malady. So I lose my nursing license and I'm, you know, this is my bread and butter. This is all I know how to do. And they said, you want to go to a diversion? You got to go to 12-step programs. And I have to go to AA to keep my nursing license. And I loved AA. I loved it. I was a paper signer and I would go to the meetings and you get the warm fuzzies when you come in and everybody's talking and you're like, these people are amazing. And I would hear you talk about alcoholism and I would think, oh my God, I'm so glad that you found AA because you are an alcoholic and you know, you're getting the solution in AA. But I didn't relate that I was an alcoholic at that point. And I went about my way and I got my license back and nothing changed. And I lost my license again because nothing changed. And they asked, did you want to do diversion again? And I just couldn't bear to fake being sober for another 2 years. I mean, you really have to be pretty on top of your game to like drink and figure out how you're going to go and show up for a drug test. If you get called the next morning, you know, all this math, you know, 1 ounce of alcohol takes an hour to metabolize. So if I have 12 drinks and that's 12 hours, no, thank you. You know, I don't want to have to fake signing my court cards anymore. So I went on my way and my drug use got worse. It took me to some dark places. Crack, heroin, boom, boom, boom. It's all not enough, never enough. Drinking saved me. Drinking kept me going. Drinking kept me from killing myself. Drinking got me through withdrawal. I never knew alcohol was the problem. And my family got so sick of watching me spin out of control. Because now I can't hide it any. You can't hide a lifestyle like that. You know, you can't. It was really apparent and I couldn't support myself. And I was living with my sweet little grandma in Philly with my son. That relationship didn't last. And I'm single momming and I'm, it's just bad, you guys. I mean, I couldn't show up for that kid. I couldn't show up at all. And every story that I like want to like make go away, it revolves me and my drinking. It's not the drug use. Like I couldn't get up in the morning because I would be hungover. I couldn't walk him to school. And we lived a mile from his kindergarten in not a great neighborhood of Philly. And I would make this little six-year-old walk himself a mile to school because I couldn't get up. And I would just trust that the crossing guards were going to help him. And when I finally could get up and go pick him up afterwards, I would have to stop at the bar just to make it a mile home. And once I'm in the bar, we're not leaving. We're not leaving. And strangers would have to buy my kid dinner and strangers would give him quarters to play the video games. And I just did my thing. And strangers would drive us home at like 9:30 at night on school nights. And this kid had to come with me while that was the life I was leading. One terrible time, I borrowed my grandma's car to go pick him up and stopped at the bar and had a couple margaritas on the way and got into an accident and almost got arrested for drunk driving. And I told you I'm a little firecracker when I'm drinking. So I'm fighting with the cops and like just totally in denial that I have done anything wrong. And they actually did me a favor by not arresting me, but they put me in the back of the cop car. And I said, I got to go get my kid from school, thinking that's the solid out. Guess what they did? They drove me in the back of the cop car to pick my kid up from first grade. And I had my little child had to get in the back of a cop car outside of school to get a ride home because mom got arrested. And you could not tell me that any of that had to do with drinking. You could not tell me that I had a part in any of that. I had it all figured out, all the reasons for denial and the hard life I had and why, you know, if you felt, you know, the way I felt you would do this too and how you're rationalized and justified. And I'm not the bad guy here. And anyway, God, I mean, I could talk the whole hour about stuff like that, but who wants to hear that? That's why we're all here, because we all have similar experiences. So what happened was I moved to California. And when I showed up here, I was like, I'm not going to do that. Not going to do that. I'm going to be sober. And when I showed up, I didn't pick up drugs, but I could not stop drinking. And I could no longer deny that alcohol was a problem. I was drinking in the morning. My hands would shake when I would wake up. Get out of here. My husband coming in to lay an eye on me. I mean, I got here to start a new life in sobriety, and I didn't know what sobriety was going to be. And I thought alcohol could be part of it. And I had this magic list of all the things that if I could get, that I'd probably be okay. If I get a relationship, someone could love me. I could feel good about myself. I wouldn't need to drink. If I could get a job, like a 9-to-5 job, not a bartending job or a waitressing job, then I would have a sense of integrity and I wouldn't need to drink. If I could just get my kid to school, if I could just get a license, if I could have a bank account, if I could keep a cell phone rolling. I don't know about you and what your relationship with your higher power is, but my higher power knows all my bull way too well. And guess what I got? All of that stuff, all of it. Relationship with another alcoholic, a job, minimum wage. Now I feel like I deserve better. Get my license back. No, my car is not. It just everything I got, all of my needs were being met. And what was left for me to understand, and thank you for that, higher power, was that I have a problem with alcohol and nothing in my life is going to change until I change that. And I had to look at my powerlessness. And for the first time, I suffered from spiritual malady and I knew it. I knew it. Before I was suffering and I didn't know it. I would be overwhelmed with fear, but I don't know fear. I know anger and I know sadness. And I would cry all day or look for fights all day. I was like a wild animal. I couldn't be around people. If I was walking down the street, I would cross the street so I didn't have to look people in the eye. Or I would like be totally over the top, like trying to absorb attention any way I could get it. Like I was a crazy person, wild animal, crazy person. I lived like that for 3 years, knowing I was an alcoholic, knowing nothing in my life could change until I could figure out this alcohol thing. And I did a lot of stupid stuff around trying to fix it. Some of it, you know, might've been worth okay if I wasn't an alcoholic of the type that has a physical allergy and a spiritual malady and a mental obsession. Maybe if I just had a physical allergy, some of it would have worked, but I mean, I did it all. And it finally became very clear to me that what we talk about in step one, that I have no power over it. It's bigger than me. It's so much bigger than me. And I will never be able to do anything about it. And to live like that is broken if you don't know what to do with it. And I told you I was dating a guy, nice fellow alcoholic, and he started getting sober in AA and wouldn't hang out with me, which honestly irritated me because I wanted to be sober. So if you're going to AA and getting sober, then we definitely have to keep dating because I need to get sober. And I would do crazy lady stuff, you know, call and poke and show up at your house and like just step on the toes of our foes, as we so nicely put it in our book. And this guy was like, back off, you need to go to AA. And I heard it loud and clear. And I made a plan to go to an AA meeting on February 29th, 2008. And, you know, the truth of it was, I knew I needed to do something different. And I was willing to take the suggestion. And I was terrified. You guys, my heart was pounding out of my chest. And I drank that day. I don't know how to do anything different. And in 2008 was the year of Sparks Malt Liquor. Anybody remember them? These are like Red Bull energy drinks that have malt liquor in them. And I would drink like 12 a day. So maybe that's why my heart was pounding out of my chest. Maybe not. I don't know. But I went there and I had an experience that a lot of people don't have an AA. And that's cool if it's not yours. But I want to tell you. I had a profound experience at that meeting that night. I was so insecure and frightened and ashamed. And I showed up late and I sat in the back and I was so mad at all the joy in the room that night. It wasn't like when I went before and I thought, how wonderful for you. I was so uncomfortable with the joy and the peace. And what I know was I was so desperate for some relief. And to find relief in that room and not understand that it was there for me if I wanted it was unbearable. I didn't know how to make that leap. And we don't have to know. You know, what I know today is we don't have to know. Just show up. Just be willing. Just come as you are. Open mind, open heart, honesty, willingness. That's how we do it. And I'll never forget there was a guy sitting behind me and he had his kid with him. And he was telling a friend that they were going to go camping this weekend. And I was blown away, blown away. People know you're an alcoholic and your kid knows you're an alcoholic and you're doing stuff. Like it did not ever occur to me that I could have a happy, transparent, authentic life acknowledging alcoholism as a problem that I couldn't control. I never seen that. I told you I grew up around alcoholism, but nobody got sober. we just stay miserable. We stay married in the same person we can't stand. We, you know, get unemployed, disability, fight, lose cars, trouble, drama, law, legal, financial problems, no solution. I've never seen it all the way through. And when those people talked that night, they talked about their alcoholism with details, like I did tonight. And I heard a lot that I related to. And I knew, oh, hell yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Oh, totally. Me too. Every single person, young man, old woman, different race, different culture, you name it, you know, but I could not deny the similarities that were going on. And here's the cool piece is that they talked about what they did and their lives. And it gave me so much hope. I never seen that. And I just knew, I know I'm doing this almost like in a real pushy Broadway. Like I'm here. You're going to have to deal with me. I am here, people. Tell me what I do. I'm doing it. And I treated it like school because, you know, good student. I got the books. I looked for suggestions. I did everything that people told me. And I did it day by day. You hear like one day at a time and like all that stuff I had heard. And I thought, jaded, hokey, corny. But when I came so broken, ready for some peace and solution, like I started to get it. Oh, I just do what I need to do today. As somebody told me last night, call somebody on the phone list. Just call somebody on the phone list. So I called somebody on the phone. They didn't answer. I didn't leave a message, but I did it. And I didn't drink that day. And that would just happen over and over. And when I would wake up in the morning where that hole, that restless hole was that needed some whiskey to soothe it, it was gone. I mean, the obsession to drink was gone, you know, and I started to feel uncomfortable. And I was here for it. I was ready to just do it, you know, and I started to like put days together. And I just love AA. I love it so much. I know this is also not everyone's experience to have that obsession gone immediately like that. But I told you, if you show up honest, open mind, willing, you'll find a power greater than yourself that will do business the way you need to do it. I'm going to just, you know, fast forward a little bit. I'm still sober. I stayed sober for some years, you know, and after that first year, I was like, I got this. I got it. I figured it out. Steps, traditions, concepts, whatever. But I started to like see the spiritual principles were like, universal spiritual principles. We're not doing anything original in AA. We took the best ideas from different spiritualities all over, and I started to make it very scientific. Like, why would this have anything to do with God? What if it's just I just do these actions and the results are sobriety and peace? Like, what does God have to do with any of that? And I started to believe that, you know, I'm starting to talk myself into being the higher power again. Which is amazing because I drank for 3 years knowing that nothing I could do would be able to relieve my alcoholism. And I knew that to be true. So all of a sudden, I'm redeciding the past. And someone pointed out to me, whoa, wait a minute. Didn't you say that your obsession to drink was gone after your very first meeting? And, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah, that happened to me. Totally true. Well, did you know the steps? Did you have a sponsor? Did you know third step prayer? Like, did you know any of the spiritual principles when that happened? No, I didn't. And it started to reinforce the truth again, you know? And I love that that's my experience because that's how my little mind wants to work it. That I don't need this. I got this. I'm smarter than this. And I figured it out. And like, because of my very profound experience after one meeting, I can never know that to be true. I can never, never deny that power. So other people have different experiences, and good, because you probably need it to have it that way. I have about 15 minutes, need a little list. You know, what I heard in beginning AA, simple solutions, get a sponsor, work the steps, do service, go to as many meetings as you can, get a home group. I did all those things. And you start to see why, you know, like the lights come on and like the joy and the peace and it all comes back into your life if you keep showing up. And that happened for me. And the service piece I love so much because I told you I like to, I'm not very, I have a hard time with higher power and faith. That little girl that like was so like full of justice and righteousness and sang in the choir, she had no problem trusting and believing that all was okay in the world, and that I didn't really have to struggle or work as hard as I think I do to have my needs met. But she grew up and she grew up in Catholic school. I had 12 years of Catholic school. I went to Catholic grade school, Catholic high school, and even 2 years of Catholic college. And I just, you know, had a hard time believing that all that education on God and the inability to feel any connection with something made sense. What it meant to me was that it's probably bull, you know? AA helped me with that. The beautiful way the steps are written so that I just have to understand that I'm not the highest power is a good gateway. And when I showed up, the way the steps go, to have to do step one and understand how powerless I truly am over alcohol, what that showed me was alcohol is a power greater than you. Oh, well, isn't that interesting? Because I can make alcohol. I could go on the internet and find a recipe and make myself some wine. So, you know, it's a thing. And to know the truth that it could be a power greater than me really just blasted the door open. Well, if that's possible, then other things can be a power greater than you too. And I just kept rolling with it, you know, and then I got to do a lot of service. I'm a doer, you know, I'm a doer. I'm not a faither, I'm a doer. So, you know, service, no problem. Go to meetings, no problem. Have faith that all your needs are met, problem. We got a problem, we got a problem. And when I was doing that service, I learned the secret of it. It's a trick, you guys. I mean, I show up and I'm forced to do an action that makes me think of something other than myself. What happens on the back end is that this channel between me and a higher power becomes clear because I'm not cluttering it up. And it's a natural connection that just happens. It just happens. And that has been proven to me over and over and over again. And I love to say my higher power has such a funny sense of humor. Like for instance, today I had the AA police called me this morning. You guys, I was in trouble with the AA police. I currently work. I'm the alternate district committee member chair for District 08 in Contra Costa County. So, you know, I'm in general service. Long story short, I'm in general service. And what I do is I put together our little bulletin, which has our agenda for our general service meeting. And I take people's reports who have service commitments and I put it together and I email it out. Well, the AA police called me today to tell me one of the reports was wrong. I got something wrong. Okay, thank you. I'll report it up. I'll check in with the person whose commitment it was. And I called the person and I said, hey, just, you know, someone thought there was a discrepancy. They heard this at the meeting. And the person goes, no, I heard this. I said, okay. She goes, you can call them back and tell them. And I figure, oh, no, let's just leave it. You know, let's just leave it. Well, this gentleman called me today to find out what follow-up I did with his information. So now I'm irritated. Like, what the hell do you care? You don't even have a general service commitment, nor are you going to be at the meeting. So could we just chill, get back in our lanes? That's my first response. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. So I give a heads up to my DCMC whose report it was. I just leave her a message and then I think, boom, boom, get back in your lane, girlfriend. You did your work now. Let it go. AA police co-chair captain calls me and he wants to tell me that he got a call from this guy and he indeed called the other person and confirmed that this information is right and your information is wrong. And I don't really want to step on toes. And I'm thinking, why are you calling me? Like, we're so, neither of us have anything to do with it. And I just, you know, I had a good day. I had prayed. I had meditated. I felt peaceful. I did my work this morning. And then this stuff showed up and I'm thinking, okay, give everybody a pass. Give everybody a pass. I hung up the phone and I had to ask myself, well, what was the motive that they really, let me give them a pass and think even in their best motive, what were they hoping? That our general service reps have the most accurate information so we can serve AA better. And I went with that and decided it won't matter because we're not doing any discussion at our meeting. The delegate's coming, so there's no room for discussion anyway. The person already asked for group feedback and another, which we're fine. This is great. We're fine. And then I go on a hike with a friend who's having a hard time. We were talking about service and I was telling her about the AA police. And she was like, yeah, I heard that about general service. I heard it's all, you know, bull like that. And I got, oh, you know what it is? I had like a light bulb moment. I was like, no, you know what it is? it's an opportunity to do a deeper level of service. Like when I go to my home group and I do coffee, I just hang out by myself and maybe have 5 or 10 minutes of conversation at most with people. And this kind of service is like, I got to sit with people and connect and like really get intimate and like really, really work one-on-one with a lot of personalities that I'm not normally exposed to. And I thought, how cool that I have been chosen for that. Like, I think I can handle that. And I know everybody can't, but it just really like gave me some new eyeballs to look at stuff. Like what a cool opportunity I get to like be a recipient for the AA police and a buffer for the people that need to do the thing. You know, we'll see if I feel that way tomorrow. I also had one moment where I'm the secretary for my home group, and I got voted in during COVID when it was online. I've never done it in person. And we were in survival mode. I mean, we're a huge home group, about 200 people come every Sunday to this beautiful room and we listen to a speaker. It's a beautiful thing. And we had to slam on the brakes and switch online, and people were coming because there was nowhere to go. There were no meetings. And we have a website and like good means of communication, so people could at least know there's an AA meeting here, and they were coming, but it was feeling like, okay, crisis averted. Now, how do we make it feel like AA? And I got to be voted in, and I had some ideas. And one of my ideas was that I would call people in the morning and ask them to be readers. So I'm not doing it last minute. And I said, I'm going to call people whose birthday it is. And I started doing that. And there was a girl. She hadn't been coming. And I hadn't seen her. Like, even when it was in person, I hadn't seen her. And I saw her name on the home group list for 4 years. And I thought, I don't want to bother her. I don't want to make her feel weird. I'm not going to call her. Haven't seen her. And then I thought, no, just call her. So I called her and she was like, oh my God, I haven't been in that meeting. Oh my God. Oh my God. I haven't been in that meeting so long. I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, just come. So she comes and she reads and I get to say happy 4 years person and every, yay, good to see you, and fill her up and love on her. I'm going to cry about this one. And she called me after the meeting and she said, you don't know, I was going to drink yesterday. I was going to drink. I thought, what am I doing? I'm doing nothing with my life. I'm so disconnected. I'm miserable. Why am I not drinking? And I called her and she came to the meeting and she's been back every Sunday. I didn't know that was happening. I just figured, stop deciding about what you're doing. Just stick to the plan. You decided to call people on their birthday and ask them to read. And what a cool thing, you know, to just be a channel. And I don't have any power in that. I didn't keep her from drinking. I just got to be a little channel. Amazing, you know, and that happens in service. And when I do that service, I see God. I see, holy cow, like what a grand master design that was. And how dare I get in the way and almost screw that up. Like how perfect that was. Couldn't have thought of it better. And, you know, if I'm having a good day and I'm doing my work, then I get to see how I just get to be one little person in the world, just one little person in the world with all you wonderful people. And I think of the miracle that happened in my life. You guys, you just heard me tell you who I was. You know, this, let me tell you, this guy, there he is. There's my little son. He just turned 23. This child that I almost killed because of my spiritual malady that was so untreated. He's 23. He lives on his own. He calls me. He invites me into his life. He treats me like a safe person. We respect each other. And I don't deserve that at all. That's AA stuff. I mean, that kid came with me to AA meetings. He would do his little homework in the corner of the meetings. And you guys just loved on him so much. So, I mean, in a way, it was kind of annoying because you'd all say hi to him before me and bring him candy and not even think about me. But just what a safe place AA has provided me to figure out how to be a human being, you know, and how to help me soften up my rough edges, you know. And when I come to meetings, home group, service, and do that stuff with you, I'm a better person in the world. I go to work and I'm not pissing people off, you know. I'm in my marriage and I am a servant, you know. It's hard to be a 40-something year old woman in 2021 who has her own job and can pay her own bills to pray every morning to be a servant to my husband. Those words don't feel great, but I know what they mean and I want to be that. And I know it's okay because I've got the right guy. God put the right guy in my life and he's praying to be a servant to his wife. And while we're more focused on filling each other up and how I can make your life better and add value to yours. It's being done for me. And it's just been proven over and over and over again. I want to tell you one last story and then I'll shut up. We have some COVID babies at some of the meetings I go to. One little gal showed up at this Monday night meeting and she got sober. I think it was like June. It's going to be a year. And she's never been to an in-person meeting. And just to watch her, watch what she did, watch her take suggestions, watch her take over the tech host to like come in and like get commitments and like get phone numbers. And like, I thought I was just, you know, treating her like another person in the meeting. And my husband said, what do you know about Danica? Do you know what she does for a living? And I was like, oh my God, I don't know anything about her. And I thought, oh my God, okay, let me start texting her. I start texting her and we find out we both like to run. And now another sponsor who likes to run, and we start this like running group and we go out and we run and like we talk sobriety. And I get to watch her life blow up. She's back in school. She did house sitting for me. She's gonna be a year sober. And just watching the fire come on for this lady like has added so much value to my AA life. And we went on a 13-mile run yesterday, me and a bunch of AA ladies. We're all vaccinated. We're ready to move on. And she was talking about how she wakes up in the morning and she has a bit of anxiety that she doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know what she likes. She doesn't know what kind of music she listens to. She doesn't know, oh my God, what is my dating life going to be like? She's like feeling very uncomfortable to have a clean slate. And I got to like sit back and reflect and be like, oh my God, me too. I don't know who I'm going to be when I wake up in the morning. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I don't know. But how for her, it has felt like a raw nerve to be so turned inside out and vulnerable in sobriety has become such a relief to me. And what a gift. And like, just to like have that talk with somebody and like be like, this is freaking amazing. How do you get from there to here? How do you do it? How do you connect the dots? And I just love to be able to come and share that experience with you today. So it's 2 minutes of, I think I'm going to be quiet now and I can't wait to see what questions you have. Oh my goodness. Thank you for letting me share.
Oh, Meg, thank you so much. Everybody has the ability to unmute and thank Meg real quickly.
Thank you, Meg.
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 Thank you,
Meg.
Much,
thank
Meg.
You, Meg.
Thank you, Meg.
Thank you for sharing, Meg.
Thanks awesome. For sharing. Yes.
Thank you, Meg.
All right. Let's give Meg. We'll give Meg a break, and we'll do a little bit of business here. I'm going to remind everybody that the user questions in the chat is looking for your questions. And we'll get a chance to thank Meg again at the end of the meeting as well. I've placed a couple of links in the chat. One of them, again, is to the simpleactions.net website where you can sign up for an email list or there's announcements of things that are happening in our group. There's also a link to the Seventh Tradition basket on PayPal. The Seventh Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? All right, I'll do one while you're thinking about that. This home group, the Simple Actions group, we've got a workshop coming up on Wednesday, June 2nd, between 7 and 8:30 p.m. It's at the regular Simple Actions Monday night meeting link. This information is also available on tidewaterintergroup.org as well as the simpleactions.net website. But it's this coming Wednesday. We've got Polly P, who's 44-ish years sober, and her son, James L., who's 36, 7 years sober, something like that. And they do a mother-son presentation on the family afterwards. So we'll let them do their thing, and then we'll have an opportunity to ask them some questions. That is open to everyone. We hope to see you there this Wednesday, 7 o'clock. Anybody else? Ebony, come on, I see you smiling. Are you going to make an announcement?
Hey, y'all, I'm an alcoholic. Norfolk District 14, in conjunction with Tidewater Intergroup, will be hosting our state delegate on June the 12th. That's a Saturday at 1 p.m. There's lots of things moving and shaking in Alcoholics Anonymous. Come find out. You know, we've got a new preamble. There's more things in the works. She will be giving her presentation on June 12th at 1 p.m. It will be hosted on Zoom. You can find that info on tidewaterintergroup.org. Thanks.
Thank you, Ebony. Anybody else? All righty. I hope those questions are coming in. Simple Actions is a home group. Yeah, I'm in the right place in the script. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All righty then. So let's switch over and see what kind of questions we got. Oh, we've only got two. Come on. You guys can do better than that. Meg, thank you so much for coming to share tonight. That was amazing. What were some of the ways that you tried to treat your alcoholism before AA? You mentioned you had a few things you were using to combat your alcoholism before AA.
Well, my favorite one was having a meltdown at Thanksgiving and demanding that someone buy me a sewing machine because I needed to express my creativity more, and went to the thrift store to get some sewing patterns and tried to make some skirts with a McCall's sewing pattern. And I tried exercise. I got a gym membership and would do stupid stuff like go and drink in the locker room and then forget the combination to my locker and have to have people open up my locker and there'd be empty beer cans in there. And reading a lot of self-help books. I read lots of self-help books, you know, changing jobs, being unemployed. I thought maybe if I could just have no job, but my favorite was relationships, dating, finding guys to make me feel better about myself. Rehab was a no-no. I was too embarrassed. I was really terrified that if I had to say out loud that I was an alcoholic, that it would just be bad. I thought I would lose my son. You know, I did it all the hard way. I mean, now that I'm sober, I know the easiest thing to do is just to be honest and ask for help, go to AA meetings. I did it all the hard way, right? So they were some.
Awesome. Would you maybe say a few words about that early sponsorship, like how you were maybe taken through that first inventory and how that went?
Yes. Yes, that is actually one of the most powerful experiences I had. You know, that guy that I was, and I'm going to air quote it, dating, I kept dating him in early sobriety because I thought, well, since we had a relationship before AA, it didn't count as dating in while you're a newcomer. I thought it was like a grandfather clause thing. And it was toxic, you know, because we were both sick. And my sponsor told me you probably shouldn't date. It's a suggestion. And I'll leave it at that. And I was like, thank you. I don't think this one counts. And we would work the steps. I'd go to her house once a week and we would work the steps, read the book, and then work the steps as it would come up. And what happened was that relationship hit it just blew up. It turns out this guy had a sex addiction and was sleeping with hookers. And why did I know? Because I didn't feel safe and broke into his house and read his four step and looked through his emails and was like a stalker. I broke and entered, I broke the law and like lost it. And what happened was I learned quickly why we have that suggestion of maybe give yourself time to become sober and grow in sobriety before you get entangled in romantic relationships. Yeah, because I felt like I was going to drink. It was just too heavy and too hard. And I went, was right before I was going to meet her for our meeting, our step work meeting. And I like flew into the diner where we met like a mess crying. Oh, I need you right now. And, she was meeting her sponsor and said, go away and come back in an hour. It's not time yet. And when I came back, I told her everything and God love her. I mean, she did not say, you're a crazy bitch. What do you think? When you read people's inventories, you get what you get. She said, oh my God, this is perfect. Cause guess what we're going to do? We're going to read step four in the big book. That's exactly where we are. And I had to work inventory in real time around it and like learn how you apply the principles of steps to your life while it's going on. And I'm, you know, one of the lucky ones where like, I just could only be honest just enough to get it through or just enough willing to do the inventory work. Like I only had just a little bit of whatever it was that I needed to keep moving and understand like, wow, that was a big deal. So I got to learn inventory in real time, and that relationship obviously didn't work out and it went away, and like I had to do amends. And then when the amends came up, I thought, oh, I need to call him and make amends. And she was like, honey, your amends is to stay away. Didn't he say never wanted to talk to you again? That's your amends. And I was like, oh, okay. So I had to do that. And you know, I thought I'd never be okay until I got my amends from him. And you know, it went away, and I met my husband. I kept doing AA, and eventually I did get a call from that guy to make amends, and I didn't need it by the time it came. I had healed. you know, I think my experience, that sponsor moved away, and I had to get a new one, and I've had a bunch of sponsors, not how I thought I would do it. I thought I'd have one sponsor, and she would be my old lady sponsor for years and years, and it just would be me and her until we died, and it didn't work out that way, and the one I have now, I've worked with for 8 years, and I'm so grateful that I did get the chance to have multiple experiences and perceptions of steps with other sponsors, and I'm also grateful to have a long-term relationship with one. I'm just so grateful for that, and to, you know, just have someone who will always keep plugging me into the steps because my life changes. And what that means is I think I need a bigger, better solution, different steps, or, you know, can't be the same thing. And it always is. And I just need somebody to like objectively mirror back, like, this is what it looks like now. Here's how you do resentment when there are no resentments. It's called fear inventory. You know, here's step four when, you know, you're not a crazy person anymore and it's all about fear. Here's your new relationship. Let's do ideals. Let's talk about, you know, that step five. And here's how we do inventory now, you know? So that's, sponsoring is awesome. What I do know is there's less emphasis on who your sponsor is and more emphasis on how willing you are to do the work. So that was a hard one to learn.
Did you have the experience of holding anything back on that first fifth step?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I showed up really messed up, really broken, and really like, out of touch with emotion and not knowing the truth about my life. And I did the best I could. And I had that experience where like there was something, it was more of a thought that I had, which didn't really fit. It wasn't really a fear. It wasn't really a resentment. It wasn't a sex inventory thing, but it took up space in my head and I was ashamed of it. And thank God I had a sponsor who followed the book and said, is there anything you left out? And I just said, yeah, this. And then she took that thought that I had and shared experience around it. And I couldn't have planned it. I mean, I thought I was the only one in the world who had this thought. And he or she had had like a long history of experience and like got to tell me about it and just kind of diffuse the power around it. And when I was doing that, you know, 13 miles takes about 2.5 hours to do when you run with slow people. So when I was with this newcomer chick yesterday, she's doing her men's. And we were talking about that. And I got to share with her, like, I'm so glad I didn't sleep on my men's. And then I did the hard ones, because you really only can see the big ones right off the bat. You only know, where did I break the law? Who do I owe money to? And like, who are my very immediate relationships? who did I punch? You know, that kind of stuff. And I'm glad I did the work then, because what happens, the longer I stay sober, I can see my part way more intimately and deeply. And like, yeah, I'm so aware of stuff that I couldn't have seen. And I guess that it's kind of cheating, but I'm glad I did those amends. And like, when that stuff comes up, that it's really just keep plugging it into the living amends. You know, like, now I just have to always be like the best person I can be, have the best relationship I can, instead of run back and be like, another thing I remember that time, I'm so sorry I did that. Like, I don't have to keep doing that. So she was like, oh, good point. So if I get it done now, it's easier.
Awesome. Would you be willing to give an example of how step 6 and 7 have worked in your life?
Oh, God. Okay, I don't know who asked that question, but man, did you pick a tough one for me? Because I mentioned about like a little bit of thinking that I'm smarter than needing a God. So, you know, step 6 asks us to like identify our shortcomings. I can do that. But step 7 asks us to like humbly ask someone to relieve them from us. And I like had worked myself into this circle of like overthinking these steps. Like for the first couple of years, it was like, yeah, okay, all right, let's move on. We're doing that, probably doing that, that's fine. And then I had a sponsor who wanted to dig into them more. All those tiny steps that you think, I'm not really sure how to do this, let's skip it, turn out to be like the hugest ones ever, right? Like step 2 and like all those are like, whoa. That was a trick. But the step 6 and 7, there came a time when I heard a speaker talk about like you take your inventory, and I did this with my sponsor, and that last column, my part, now all that can get pushed into step 6 and 7, and my job is to look for it's where it's coming up. And then I make a contract with my higher power where like I've identified these things as it comes up. My part of the contract is I will practice the opposite. I will no longer just full force ahead, blindly practice behavior. I will try to be aware and practice the opposite. For instance, like if I feel jealous in a relationship, I'm going to practice being trusting if I feel that jealousy coming up. Or if I feel anger towards someone, I'm going to practice trying to love them. And it was real clear to me to be put so black and white. And I was starting to get relief around a lot of character defects. I was starting to unlearn how, you know, doing them and putting these healthier ways of doing things into like real time. And I got confused because I thought, oh, what's God got to do with this? I'm doing all the work. Where is God in this at all? And it was just another opportunity for me to like understand what a higher power looks like in my world. And it looked like those things that I have no control over, like jealousy is a good one. You know, I've been in a lot of relationships where, we just weren't able to make it about love and trust. And like my son's father cheated on me all the time. So of course I think I'm going to get cheated on in every relationship. And, I would go into the world and find people that would do that, you know? And I found myself doing service, super nerdy, ad hoc committee, rewriting bylaws for our intergroup committee service. And I met my husband, who was going to be my husband. And we started having a relationship. And I called him one day and he was talking, I'm talking to a buddy from LA, I'll call you right back. Okay. He calls me back and says, yeah, I was talking to Catherine. I was like, oh, whoa, hold the phone. Catherine, your ex-girlfriend? And like, I got totally jealous. And, you know, I was knowing that, like, I need to practice on. I said, I'm so sorry. You know, I know you get to have the friends that you want to have, but that makes me super uncomfortable. Why can't you call a friend who's a man if you're lonely for your friends in LA? And this guy was like, oh, okay. I won't call her anymore if it makes you feel uncomfortable. And I never had a partner that would do that. Like, let me ask for something that maybe was unfair to ask for and make the sacrifice because our relationship was important. And if I needed help feeling I could trust it, it would be there. And what I realized was like, that's where God comes in. Like God put the right partner in my path for me to practice these things with. I'm only responsible for my behavior, but who is on the other end receiving? I have no control over that. And it goes back to what I was saying. Like, if you're doing this and your eyes are open, like everything is right in front of you. These beautiful avenues of like miracle sobriety and growth. Like, you know, like I would have never met my husband. That was outside of my control. And I got to see how like, that's where God is in those little moments. So step 6 and 7 allows me, like, I just do your part, you know, and trust that, the external stuff that feels powerless and big, somebody else has that.
Mm. Thank you. Someone wants to know, what suggestions did you take early on that you continue to pass along to others?
Get a home group. They told me early on to get a home group, and I've always had one. And it seemed kind of silly to me until you really understand, you know, like what happens in AA. If you show up, like things get good and life gets big, and it's very easy to become untethered. And home group will help you have accountability and integrity and a place to just practice making relationships with people that you're going to sell yourself short of if you don't have a landing place. I was told a home group is one meeting that you go to every week. You should always have a service commitment and you go. And if you can't go, you check in with somebody. And if somebody that goes isn't there, you check in with them. Simple. And when I started doing that, I think that's really where my life got very big. I started having like, you know, doing coffee with Tanya. Tanya's just some lady, you know, from the next neighborhood over, whatever. We show up, we do coffee. 5 years later, Tanya gets married and I get invited. 6 years later, I get married and Tanya's there. Tanya's one of my best friends now. It's like home group gave me that little safe place to practice being a human in the world with people. Being honest, another one I got early on in AA that I think saves my butt daily. It sometimes is more, I think it's annoying, but it really is more helpful than anything, was to call. My first sponsor told me call 3 people in AA a day. And this was back before I had an iPhone. So I like couldn't really text, I had to call. And that just made me really get out of my comfort zone and learn to rely on the fellowship and give me a safety net bigger than just my sponsor. And what happens now is people call me, you know, and it's like I talked about where like, if you're doing the work in AA, you're always okay. Like there was a time I got super sick and I was in the hospital and I just, you guys, I had a tube coming out of my liver and an IV and I was on disability. And like, I couldn't pray. I couldn't do anything. I could barely sit up in a chair. And because of the work I put in AA, calling 3 people a day, people were calling me. You know, and I couldn't pray and they were filling the void for work I couldn't do. And it was like this beautiful AA snowball was rolling and I just got wrapped up in it. And when I couldn't do the work, it was being done. Like I put the work in and it was being done for me. So I think that's really important.
Thank you. So I have another tasty little question here. How do you avoid drifting into worry, remorse, or self-pity?
Worry, remorse, or something. I'm more wired to anger. I'm more of a screw you kind of person than woe is me. Well, this past year has been a really, really big challenge, right? I love that piece of the big book and the steps. I think it's step four. No, it's not the big book. It's the 12 and 12 where it talks about step four about we're humans. We have human needs. We have a need for security, shelter, relationships, food. You know, like we need that. It's survival. And how the thing with being an alcoholic is I need more than my fair share. Like even when that need is met, I still want more, 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 more. And I have always really related to that. And then I think of this past year with it's a global pandemic. Like that's a big deal, right? And everything was threatened. The way we take care of ourselves, our relationships, finances, health, every human need that you could think of was threatened. A real threat. And the work that you have to do to be okay around that. And that was crisis mode. And it was exhausting. And what I learned is that number one, human, as long as I'm wearing a human skin suit, I'm not going to be immune from that stuff. So allow it to some point, but really look at what it is. And what really worked for me was a relentless practice of step 11, which is prayer and meditation. And if anybody I sponsor, they are so sick of me because every time they call with something, I go, how is your step 11? It's all I know. I mean, if they said great, I'd be out of ideas. So just like finding and understanding who my higher power is and using it. Self-pity. I have some kind of hard talk with myself or like, you know, oh my God, work is hard. Oh my God, it's so hard. And yeah, it is. But sometimes I just want to be like, and why shouldn't it be? Like, why do you get a pass on the hardness of life? You know, like when that boyfriend broke up with me, it was like, and what, you never get broken up with? Like you're immune to the problems of the world. Like sometimes it's a hard way to say it. But I think the point is like, this is life, you know? Things happen in life. You're allowed to feel bad about it. You're allowed to struggle. You're allowed to make mistakes. It's that constant search for humility. Like keep it right sized. Is it appropriate? Am I having an appropriate response to the situation?
Thank you. That's a good segue actually to another question. Would you share a little bit about what step 10, 11 and 12 look like in your life today?
Boy, it feels nice to like have an answer. That little kid that I have, he went to, as much as I swear, I'd never send him to Catholic school. I sent him to Catholic school. And I remember him coming home one day and being like, Mom, we got to write a paper on religion. What's our religion? And like, it felt so good to have answers about God and higher power for him. And, I'm having that same experience. Like 10, 11, and 12 are really, you hear it called the maintenance steps, and it's really what keeps us sober, like emotional sobriety and long-term sobriety. And it's really just a way to do all the other steps in smaller, more frequent practices. I'm not an inventory writer. Early on, I had a sponsor give me a checklist of character defects and assets, and I would have to mark off every day what was going on with me. Right now I have an app that I use, and I really only use it when I'm working it with the sponsee and we share it with each other, but I'm more of a real-time person. I love, Joe and Charlie did a book study and they talk about step four and the process of step four and like understanding in the moment why I'm having a disturbance and really drilling down to like, what need am I trying to meet and how do I meet that need and like release this person from it and meet it on my own. And I do a lot of that. I try to be very real time with that stuff. So that's my 10. 11 is prayer and meditation, and that is ever evolving, and I don't get too rigid, and I don't make myself feel bad if I only did it for 5 minutes and not 20, but I will always, always make room for it. I have a spot in my house that has some reflection books, and I go there in the morning, whether it be for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever it is, but I do not skip. Sometimes if I'm feeling stressed for time, what I have learned is that means you better sit for 20 minutes, girlfriend. It is not negotiable ever. And there'll be times when I can't do it or I forget. I have a husband, and when we're free, we do it together. That has been so freaking cool to share a spiritual practice with someone. It's very embarrassing and uncomfortable, but it really helps you understand what you believe if you have to say it out loud with another person. And it brings a level of intimacy I didn't ever experience with anyone before. And step 12, I mean, what is that? Practice these principles in all our affairs. So do all these steps all the time. I mean, it's really just what I said. You know, am I paying attention with my eyes open? Do I set an ideal for who I want to be when I leave for work in the morning or when I go do the thing? Like, do I decide who I think God wants me to be? Do I have it clear? Do I have a clear definition? Because if I don't, when it starts showing up, I'm going to get confused. I don't know. I love that question. And I'm kind of hesitant to give you details because you have to figure out what's going to work with you. But the basis for it is are you looking for what works for you? Do you know how to find God in your day? And do you know how to know the truth about yourself? And are you doing the best you can?
Right on. Thank you. Well, you've been very generous with your time. We're almost out of it. We got maybe a minute left and one more question.
Okay.
What's the miracle?
The miracle?
What is it? What's the miracle?
Well, I mean, there's the very obvious heavy handed one. I mean, the broken, low bottom, trashing, lying, thieving, can't do nothing but drink and drug, above all else person that showed up here in 2008. People don't know her anymore. The person that I think I am in my heart and the person I want to be in my heart is the person people see me as. Obviously, it's that you get relief from that obsession of alcohol, you know? I'm an alcoholic for sure, but I'm not suffering from it anymore. To me, that's the miracle. Something that I thought would never happen is now real and true in my life.
Oh. Thank you so much. Everybody's going to get a chance to thank Meg again after the Lord's Prayer. I'd like to thank everybody who participated, Ebony for wrangling the questions, home group members for being awesome, and you guys for taking the time on this holiday Sunday to just be here. Leslie, would you want to read if I put something up, would you? Bless you. I should probably give you permission to unmute, and I didn't do it because I'm a work in progress.
Yay, there it is. I'm Leslie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
this
Leslie.
This is a vision for you. What's up, bud? Big book, page 164. A book is meant to be suggestive only. You realize we know only in the little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. Be committed that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Be freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then. Thanks for letting me read.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you all. Let's virtually circle up and hold hands and actually say the Lord's Prayer. Feel free to unmute. Let's make it as confusing as possible. Whose Father?
Our Father.
Our Father.
Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.
Lead us not into temptation,
but
deliver us from evil.
For thine is the
power and the glory forever. Amen.
Amen.
Woohoo! Thank you, Meg. That was awesome.
Thank you, Meg.
Thank you so very much, Meg.
Fantastic. Thank you for listening.
That was awesome. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Blessed to have had your time.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It's a fun way to spend the day.
That was awesome. Thank you so much, Meg.
Thank you. Jason or John, where are you from?
Richmond.